This is CBSI on the World. I'm John Batzer. I'm with the author and journalist, Raith Abdullahad. His new book is A Stranger in Your Own City, Travels in the Middle East, Long War. Raith, you paint a beautiful scene of your father and showing you in the high in the sky over Baghdad, an F-4 Phantom. Who was your father at that moment? What did he make of the F-4 Phantom for the, I believe you were 5 years old.
I was five. My father was a, what do we call, an amateur interested in aviation and planes, and collected all these, foreign magazines about airplanes and jet fighters. He had a few friends who were pilots in the Iraqi Air Force. So this is where he could, spot the F-4 flying over Baghdad. I really remember that day as my first war. I went to my parents' bedroom. My father later took me to the roof, seeing that was the first time I hear the sounds of heavy anti-aircraft machine guns. And it's a very interesting point because, John, because I think that's the point where all the miseries of Iraq started, that war with Iran, which led to Saddam having a very strong army, but a bankrupt country, which led him to invading Kuwait in 91, and the history is the rest.
The story includes you witnessing a parade. My date says 1989, so you were a few years older. A parade, a victory parade, though the war ended with no clear winner. Both sides, as we witness in all wars, both sides extremely grief-stricken, but at the same time claiming success. You witness a parade where there are Iranian prisoners and Iraqi soldiers. I picture the parade marching by. And you get close enough for one soldier to give you a bullet. What did you make of that? Were you excited? Was everybody excited about that parade?
So the parade was before the end of the war. I mean, of course, there was massive parades after the end of the war. And as you say, both sides claimed that they came victorious. That specific parade, I think, was around 86. And I was still young. And again, I remember my father kind of like lifting me to look at the trucks and the Iraqi soldiers. And I'm waving my hands because, militarization swept through the society. As kids, we were all wearing military uniforms to salute the flag on Thursday mornings, militarization, military cartoons, military drawings. Saddam was dressed in a military. So we were all excited as children to see the soldiers passing by. And I remember this guy, this soldier who had a tired face and gave me this bullet, red line around it. And I kept it for a long time. Little did I know that this was like an omen for all the wars to come.
Saddam Hussein is someone we routinely refer to as the president or the dictator of Iraq. However, in the Iraqi Arabic language, he was called leader of necessity. Why? What did that mean to the Iraqi people? What did it mean to Saddam Hussein?
So Saddam kind of, he comes from, follows the step of all these revolutionary or tries to play the role of a revolutionary pan-Arabist leader. So he donned the khaki uniform, he wore these big aviator glasses, smoked a cigar, and he was given, the cult of the leader, the cult of worshipping the leader. So he was given all these titles, the savior of the nation, the leader of the people. And one of the titles, which I found the most absurd title, was in Arabic, it's al-qaid al-darura, the leader necessity. It's a very absurd title. It doesn't even make sense in Arabic. But it was one of these titles coined specifically for him, and meaning, what kind of the description of it was, that this nation at a certain point will bring this leader who will lead the nation to victory and greatness. And of course, he did lead the nation, but led it to its utter defeat and demise.
The second war is when America enters around the edges about the invasion of Kuwait and the pushing of the Iraqi army out of Kuwait. And you were at this point observing Saddam, the leader of necessity, undergoing a transformation. You also had ambition as an architect. So you were looking to a future both of architecture and of Saddam Hussein, who was a semi-religious leader. Is that how he responded to the defeat in Kuwait?
So, John, you know, in the 90s, religiosity swept throughout the Middle East, and Saddam was very weakened. I mean, he personally was not weakened, but the state was weakened, and his grip on the Iraqi population was weakened. So he used religiosity for religion to fulfill two things. A, to portray himself as the pious, faithful leader, by that to counter any attempts by religious opposition parties. But two, to use religion as well as tribal relation and the tribes themselves as a way to extend his authority to different parts of the population. You know, building mosques, TV shows, you know, about religion, radio shows about religion, campaigns to memorize the Quran, all these elements he used to extend his control over the population. Because Saddam, in the first stage of his life, as he was portraying himself as the leftist revolutionary leader, the second stage, he was the pious tribal leader of the nation.
And the sanctions regime are biting hard into the Iraqi people. My sense of the sanctions, my memory is that there's a state within a state, and those who are endorsed by the regime do very well. At this point, however, I want to emphasize an observation that you make throughout the book. Iraq is not a sectarian division at this point. There are Shia who are prosperous and are blessed by the regime, and there are Sunni who are the same. So it is not like Saddam is a Sunni, and that means Shia are out. Have I got that right, Quraith, that the sectarian conflict came later and it was imposed?
Absolutely, John. Look, Sunnis and Shia and Kurds and Christians and Turkmen are all components of the Iraqi population. Of course, there are religious differences, and a few hundred years ago, you know, religious wars and sectarian conflicts. But the Iraqi society, as it was in the 80s and 90s, was predominantly defined by class, by a place of birth, rather than by sex. So intersectarian marriages were a very common thing in Iraq. The sectarian narrative imposed on Iraq, in which Saddam is a Sunni, then by association, all the Sunnis are oppressors of the Iraqi people. That narrative was created in exile in London and Tehran in the 90s and was used to market a regime change in Iraq, you know, along the side of, you know, the Kosovan wars, the Rwanda wars. That narrative was created later and was brought later to Iraq. Again, I want to emphasize, it's not like I'm not saying that there are no Sunnis or Shia in Iraq. Of course there are. Of course they have social differences between them. But the sectarian conflict between the Sunnis and Shia of Iraq happened because of the 2003 war.
The book is A Stranger in Your Own City, Travels in the Middle East, Long War. Quraith Abdulahad is the author. We're now back to the American occupation and the first civil war. I'm John Bashman.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Bachelor.
It's Cybersecurity Awareness Month. LifeLock is here with tips to help protect your identity. Use strong passwords, set up multi-factor authentication, report scams, and update your software. And for comprehensive identity protection, LifeLock is your best choice. LifeLock alerts you to suspicious uses of your personal information and fixes identity theft, guaranteed, or your money back. Start your protection today with a 30-day free trial at LifeLock.com. Use promo code NEWS. Terms apply.